A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking what decentralized finance actually means, how it's different from microlending, what we actually know about whether credit access improves economic outcomes for the unbanked, and where DeFi is genuinely making a difference versus where it's just hype. And honestly, the timing on this is perfect, because you've got these two completely different stories happening simultaneously. The same week, a Kenyan farmer gets a $50 loan through a blockchain protocol with no bank account. A Wall Street firm launches a $500 million DeFi yield fund, both called DeFi. They could not be more different.
As of the first quarter of this year, total value locked in DeFi protocols is back up to $180 billion. Meanwhile, 1.7 billion adults globally remain unbanked, according to the World Bank's latest Global Findex. The gap between those two numbers is where the real story lives.
Let's start with the basics, because the terms get thrown around like they're interchangeable and they're really not. What is DeFi in one clean sentence?
Financial services built on public blockchains, primarily Ethereum and its layer 2s, using smart contracts to replace intermediaries like banks, brokerages, and insurance companies. Instead of a loan officer at a desk deciding whether you're creditworthy, a smart contract holds collateral and executes the terms automatically. Small, uncollateralized loans, typically $50 to $500, to low-income borrowers, pioneered by Grameen Bank in the 1970s, relying on social collateral and group lending models. You borrow as part of a group, the group's reputation is on the line, and that peer pressure substitutes for a credit score.
The core distinction isn't really about loan size.
Not at all. It's about infrastructure. Microlending is a human-mediated trust model. DeFi is a code-mediated trust model. One scales through relationships, loan officers who know the borrowers, group meetings, community enforcement. The other scales through composability. Smart contracts that plug into other smart contracts, global liquidity pools, anyone can access if they have the collateral.
That's the word the crypto world uses to mean Lego blocks for money, right?
You can take a lending protocol, plug it into an insurance protocol, plug that into a stablecoin, and build something new without asking anyone's permission. A microlender in Bangladesh can't do that. They're operating inside a specific institutional and regulatory framework.
If microlending has been around for 50 years, and DeFi for barely a decade, what does the actual evidence say about whether credit access changes lives? Let's start with the data.
This is where things get uncomfortable for the microlending evangelists. The most rigorous evidence we have comes from randomized controlled trials, actual experiments where researchers randomly assigned access to microcredit and tracked outcomes. Esther Duflo and her colleagues ran one of the most cited studies in Hyderabad, India between 2005 and 2008. They found business investment went up modestly. People started or expanded small businesses. But household consumption didn't increase meaningfully. Education outcomes for children barely budged. And there was no measurable effect on women's empowerment, which had been one of the central selling points of microcredit for decades.
People borrowed money, started tiny businesses, and...
A meta-analysis by the Abdul Latif Jameel Poverty Action Lab. J-PAL looked at 7 randomized controlled trials across Bosnia, Ethiopia, India, Mexico, Mongolia, Morocco, and the Philippines. The average treatment effect on business profit was $3.50 per month. That's not a typo. Microcredit increased self-employment by 1 to 2 percentage points, but it did not lift households out of poverty in any of the studies.
Which is not the same as saying microlending is useless.
Right, and that's an important distinction. The evidence is sobering, not damning. What it says is that credit alone is not the lever. Where microlending has shown real effects, 15 to 25% income gains for female borrowers, is when it's bundled with training, healthcare, and savings products. Bangladesh's BRAC and India's Bandhan Bank didn't just hand out loans. They wrapped them in a whole ecosystem of support.
The bundle matters more than the credit itself.
That's the finding, and it makes intuitive sense. If you give someone $200 and no business training, no health insurance, no savings buffer, one medical emergency wipes out the business. The loan becomes a liability, not an asset.
Which brings us to DeFi's fundamental tension. Because DeFi doesn't offer bundles, it offers code.
More specifically, it offers over-collateralized lending. Every major DeFi lending protocol, IAV, Compound, Maker, requires borrowers to post at least 150% collateral in crypto assets. You want to borrow $100 in USDC? You need to lock up $150 in Ethereum or another approved token.
Which eliminates credit risk. The protocol doesn't need to know who you are or whether you'll pay back. If you default, it just seizes the collateral.
And that's elegant from an engineering perspective. But from a financial inclusion perspective, it's absurd. The unbanked don't have $150 in Ethereum sitting around. If they did, they wouldn't need a loan. DeFi solves the wrong problem for the population it claims to serve.
The smart contract replaces the loan officer, but also replaces the entire concept of actually assessing someone's ability to repay based on their circumstances.
It introduces a new risk that traditional microlending doesn't have, volatility risk. If you post Ethereum as collateral and the price drops 30% overnight, the protocol liquidates your position automatically. You don't get a phone call. You don't get a grace period. The smart contract just sells your collateral, often at a discount, and you're left with nothing.
There's something darkly funny about a system designed to help the unbanked that requires you to already have money to participate.
It's the financial equivalent of needing a job to get work experience. But here's where the story gets more interesting, because DeFi isn't just over-collateralized lending. That's the part that gets the most attention, but it's not where the real impact is happening.
That's the sobering reality of microlending. But DeFi is a different beast. It's not trying to replicate Grameen Bank on a blockchain. So where is it actually working? And for whom?
And none of them are what the white papers promised 5 years ago. First, stablecoin adoption in hyperinflationary economies. Argentina is the case study everyone points to now. Monthly stablecoin volume hit $8.5 billion in March of this year, according to Chainalysis, up from $2.1 billion in January 2025. That's a 400% increase in 14 months.
These aren't crypto traders speculating on dogcoins. These are ordinary people using USDC and USDT as a store of value because their local currency is losing purchasing power by the week.
Argentina's inflation rate hit 211% in 2023. When your peso is evaporating, holding dollar-denominated stablecoins on a phone is rational economic behavior. You don't need a bank account. You don't need permission. You just need a smartphone and an internet connection.
That's transformative. It's not credit, but it's financial inclusion in a very real sense. People preserving value they would otherwise lose.
It's happening at scale. This isn't a pilot program with 2,000 participants. $8.5 billion a month is real economic activity. The second area is cross-border remittances. The Stellar network processed $12 billion in remittance volume in 2025, with average fees of 0.1%. Traditional remittance services, Western Union, MoneyGram, averaged 6.5% globally according to the World Bank.
6.5% versus 0.1%. On a $200 remittance, that's $13 versus 20 cents.
For families where that $200 is 15% of monthly household income, $13 matters enormously. It's the difference between school fees and no school fees, or medicine and no medicine. The Stellar network does this by using stablecoins as the settlement layer. Send USDC on Stellar, convert to local currency at the destination through local on-ramps and off-ramps.
The blockchain is the rails. But the endpoints are still traditional money.
And that's the pattern that actually works. Pure crypto-to-crypto transactions are still a tiny slice of global commerce. The hybrid model, crypto rails, fiat endpoints, is where the volume is. The third area is institutional yield markets. BlackRock's Beidl Fund, tokenized on Ethereum, now holds $1.2 billion in treasury bills, offering 4.8% yield to accredited investors. That's not for the unbanked. It's for institutions and high-net-worth individuals who want on-chain exposure to traditional assets.
DeFi is growing fastest in three contexts: protecting savings from inflation, moving money across borders cheaply, and giving rich people another way to earn yield on government bonds. None of these are lending to the poor.
That tells you something important about where the technology actually creates value. DeFi's killer app isn't credit, it's settlement. The ability to move value globally in seconds with near zero cost and no intermediary is new infrastructure. Circle's USDC now settles $50 billion daily in volume, competing directly with SWIFT's 1 to 3 day settlement for cross-border business payments.
$50 billion a day competing with SWIFT? That's not a crypto niche anymore. That's a parallel financial system.
It's faster, cheaper, and operates 24/7. SWIFT doesn't settle on weekends or holidays. DeFi protocols never close. For a business in Nigeria trying to pay a supplier in Vietnam on a Friday afternoon, that matters.
Where has DeFi proven itself most transformative? Not in lending to the unbanked, we've established that, but in two narrow use cases that deserve more attention than they get.
The first is instant settlement of cross-border payments, which we just covered. The second is programmable insurance with parametric triggers. And this one surprised me when I dug into it. Etherisk, which is a decentralized insurance protocol, has been running crop insurance in Sri Lanka and Kenya that uses satellite rainfall data to automatically pay out claims within 24 hours of a drought event.
No claims adjuster. No 6-month wait while your crops die.
Traditional crop insurers in those regions take 6 to 18 months to process claims. By the time the payout arrives, the farmer has already sold assets, taken out high-interest loans, or pulled children out of school. Etherisk enrolled 2,400 farmers in Kenya. The average payout was $180 per claim. And here's the number that stuck with me, 99.7% automated settlement rate. Nearly every claim that triggered based on the satellite data was paid automatically within a day.
$180 arrives in 24 hours versus 6 months. That's not a marginal improvement, that's a different product entirely.
It's the difference between insurance that actually works as insurance, and insurance that's just a promise you hope gets honored eventually. Parametric insurance isn't new. The World Bank has been experimenting with it for years, but putting it on a blockchain with smart contracts makes it transparent, automated, and cheap enough to serve smallholder farmers who were previously uninsurable.
This ties back to what you said about bundles. The insurance is the missing piece that makes credit viable. If a farmer knows drought will trigger an automatic payout, a lender might actually be willing to extend credit for seeds and fertilizer.
Now you're describing the real vision. Not DeFi replacing microlending, but DeFi providing the infrastructure layer that makes microlending and other traditional services work better. The credit, the insurance, the savings, they become composable in the way we talked about earlier.
That vision requires something DeFi doesn't have yet: reliable identity and credit history for the populations it claims to want to serve.
That's where the failed promises come in. Projects like Celo's Mula Market and Akela's AUSD tried to create mobile-first lending for emerging markets. Mula Market's total value locked peaked at $120 million in 2022. It's now below $5 million. Akala's AUSD stablecoin depegged in 2022 after a protocol exploit and never recovered. The core problem wasn't technology. It was the absence of reliable identity, credit history, and legal recourse in the populations these protocols claim to serve. If you lend to someone pseudonymously and they default, what do you do? There's no court to appeal to, no collateral to seize, no credit bureau to report to. The entire micro-lending model works because the social cost of defaulting on your group is high. DeFi has no equivalent mechanism.
The pseudonymity that crypto enthusiasts treat as a feature is actually a bug for lending to the poor.
The unbanked are not anonymous. They're invisible to formal systems. There's a difference. An anonymous person is hiding their identity. An invisible person has an identity, a name, a community, a history of informal transactions, but no institution has recorded it in a usable format. DeFi's pseudonymous model treats everyone as anonymous, which means it can't distinguish between someone with a 15-year history of repaying informal loans and someone who's never borrowed before.
That's a really useful distinction. Invisible versus anonymous.
It points to what the solution might actually look like. There's an emerging hybrid model that I think is the most interesting development in this space right now. Projects like Cred Protocol and Spectral are using on-chain transaction history to generate credit scores for DeFi borrowers, enabling under-collateralized loans up to 30% loan-to-value ratio. As of this month, Spectral has issued $45 million in under-collateralized loans with a default rate of 4.2%.
4.2%? How does that compare to traditional consumer credit?
Traditional consumer credit card default rates in the U.S. are around 3.5%, according to the Federal Reserve. So Spectral's default rate is higher, but not dramatically so, and this is lending to a population that traditional credit bureaus can't score. The model works by analyzing wallet history. How long has this address been active? What's the transaction volume? Has it ever been liquidated? Does it interact with known legitimate protocols or sketchy ones?
It's the blockchain equivalent of a bank looking at your checking account history before approving a loan.
But it's still limited. 45 million in total loans is tiny compared to the global microcredit market, which is estimated at over $120 billion. And the population that has meaningful on-chain history is still overwhelmingly crypto-native, people who already have assets and understand the technology.
Which circles us back to the fundamental question. Is DeFi actually serving the unbanked, or is it serving the already banked who want better tools?
Today, overwhelmingly the latter. The exceptions, Parametric Insurance in Kenya, stablecoin savings in Argentina, cheap remittances on Stellar, are real and important, but they're not DeFi lending. They're DeFi infrastructure being used for specific purposes that happen to benefit some underserved populations.
The DeFi lending protocols that get all the venture capital and headlines, Aave, Compound, are essentially serving crypto-native users who want to leverage their existing holdings.
Which is a legitimate use case. If you're holding Ethereum and believe it'll appreciate, borrowing stablecoins against it lets you access liquidity without selling and triggering a taxable event. That's useful. It's just not financial inclusion.
DeFi is transforming cross-border payments and parametric insurance, but it's not replacing microlending. What does that mean for someone trying to figure out where to pay attention?
I think it means three things. First, if you're evaluating a DeFi project that claims to serve the unbanked, ask two questions. How do they handle identity and credit history? And what's their actual default rate and collateralization ratio? If the answer to the second question is over-collateralized only, they are not serving the unbanked. They're serving crypto holders.
That's a good filter. What's the second takeaway?
The most impactful DeFi applications today are not lending protocols. They're stablecoins for savings in inflationary economies and parametric insurance for climate-vulnerable populations. These are the use cases that solve real problems without requiring crypto-native wealth. If you care about financial inclusion, pay attention to stablecoin adoption in Argentina, Nigeria, Turkey, not to the latest lending protocol launching on a new layer 2. The future of inclusive DeFi probably involves on-chain credit scoring from alternative data, combined with traditional know-your-customer and anti-money laundering infrastructure. The pure pseudonymous model cannot serve the unbanked because the unbanked are not anonymous, they are invisible. Making them visible requires some form of identity verification, which means the system has to connect to the off-chain world.
Which is philosophically uncomfortable for a lot of people in crypto. The whole point was supposed to be trustless, permissionless, no gatekeepers.
That works beautifully for certain things. Moving money across borders, providing transparent insurance payouts, giving people in hyperinflationary economies a way to save. Those don't require identity, they just require a smartphone. But credit requires knowing who you're lending to. There's no way around that. Every society that has developed functional credit markets has built institutions to assess and track creditworthiness. DeFi can make those institutions more efficient and more accessible, but it can't eliminate the need for them.
Unless you go the over-collateralized route, in which case you don't need to know anything about the borrower, because the collateral does all the work. But then you're not serving the unbanked.
And that's the trade-off that the industry has been unwilling to acknowledge honestly. You can have trustless lending, or you can have lending to people without assets. You can't have both.
Let me push back on that slightly. What about the Spectral model? On-chain credit scoring? That is trustless in the sense that it's algorithmic, but it's not collateralized in the traditional sense.
It's a step in the right direction, but it's still only serving people who already have on-chain history. The truly unbanked, the farmer in rural Kenya who's never used a smartphone wallet, has no on-chain history to score. Spectral's model works for the underbanked in crypto-savvy markets, which is valuable but limited. The farmer in Kenya needs something different, probably a combination of traditional group lending, parametric insurance, and mobile money rails. DeFi can provide the insurance and the rails, but the group lending still requires human trust.
The vision where DeFi replaces the whole stack is wrong, but the vision where DeFi provides specific infrastructure layers within a broader system is actually happening.
And I think that's a more interesting story than the maximalist version anyway. The maximalist version, DeFi will bank the unbanked, was always a fantasy. But the infrastructure version, DeFi can make existing financial services cheaper, faster, and more transparent, is real and measurable.
Let's talk about one more dimension of this that I think gets overlooked. The Federal Reserve's 2023 Survey of Household Economics found that 12% of you adults are underbanked. They have a bank account but still use alternative financial services like payday lenders. For them, the binding constraint isn't access to banking, it's the cost of credit.
Payday loans carry an average APR of 391%, according to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's 2024 report. 391%. That's not a typo either. Someone borrowing $500 for 3 months could end up paying back over $1,000.
In theory, DeFi's algorithmic underwriting and global liquidity pools could lower that cost. If you can assess credit risk more accurately and source capital from global markets instead of local loan sharks, the interest rate should come down.
In theory, yes. In practice, we're not there yet. The Spectral model at 4.2% default rate suggests it's possible to do under-collateralized lending at reasonable rates, but $45 million in total volume is a rounding error in the payday lending market. Payday lending industry alone is over $30 billion a year.
The gap between proof of concept and actual market impact is still enormous.
It's not just a technology gap, it's a regulatory gap. Payday lending exists because it's legal in many states, not because the technology for cheaper lending doesn't exist. Credit unions and community banks could offer small dollar loans at much lower rates, and some do, but they're constrained by regulation and underwriting costs. DeFi protocols operating outside the regulatory perimeter might be able to offer lower rates, but they also operate without the consumer protections that traditional lenders are subject to.
Which means borrowers might get lower rates but fewer protections. That's not obviously a win.
It depends on the alternative. If your choice is a 391% payday loan with some consumer protections versus a 40% DeFi loan with no consumer protections, which is better? I'm not sure there's an obvious answer. The 40% loan is cheaper, but if something goes wrong, a smart contract bug, a protocol exploit, a liquidation during a flash crash, you have no recourse.
The people borrowing at 391% are not in a position to evaluate smart contract risk.
Which is why I think the hybrid model, DeFi infrastructure with traditional financial institution interfaces, is the most likely path. The user deals with the regulated entity they can sue if something goes wrong. That entity uses DeFi rails on the back end to access cheaper liquidity and faster settlement. The user doesn't need to know what a smart contract is.
Like how most people don't know what SWIFT is, but use it every time they wire money.
The technology disappears into the infrastructure.
Let's pull on a thread you mentioned earlier. Central bank digital currencies. Nigeria's Naira now has 13 million wallets. China's digital yuan has 260 million. How does that change the equation?
It blurs the line between DeFi and traditional finance in ways that could go either direction. On one hand, if every citizen has a digital wallet issued by their central bank, they're now technically on digital financial rails. That could make it easier to connect them to DeFi protocols for savings, insurance, and eventually credit.
On the other hand, a central bank digital currency is the opposite of decentralized. The government can see every transaction, freeze accounts, impose spending limits.
That's the tension. The people who built DeFi wanted to escape government-controlled money, but the people who need financial inclusion most are precisely the ones governments are trying to reach with central bank digital currencies. The question is whether the resulting system is more inclusive or just more efficient at excluding the same people.
More efficient at excluding? That's a dark phrase. What do you mean?
If credit scoring moves on-chain and becomes more automated, the people who are already excluded from formal credit, no bank history, no property records, no formal employment, might become even more excluded because the algorithms will be better at identifying them as high risk. The old system excluded them through bureaucracy and friction. The new system might exclude them through precision.
The technology that's supposed to democratize finance could actually entrench existing inequalities more efficiently.
That's the risk. It's not inevitable, but it's the default path if we're not intentional about design. The parametric insurance example shows it doesn't have to go that way. Etherisk is serving farmers who were previously uninsurable. But insurance is different from credit. Insurance pays out based on objective triggers. Did it rain less than X millimeters in the past 30 days? Credit requires assessing individual behavior and circumstances, which is much harder to automate fairly.
The microlending evidence suggests that even when you get credit assessment right, credit alone doesn't transform lives. You need the bundle, training, healthcare, savings, insurance.
Which is why I'm more excited about DeFi as infrastructure for those other pieces than as a direct lending platform. Cheap remittances, stable savings, automated insurance, those are the building blocks that make everything else possible. Credit might come last, not first.
If someone's listening and thinking about where to put their attention or their capital, what's the framework?
1. Is this project solving a real problem for a specific population, or is it a solution in search of a problem? Stablecoins for Argentines, real problem, specific population. Yield farming protocol number 47, solution in search of a problem. 2. Does the project require crypto-native wealth to participate, or can someone with no assets start benefiting? If it requires crypto wealth, it's not for the unbanked. 3. How does the project handle identity and recourse? If the answer is, we don't, it's probably not viable for credit applications at scale.
That's a useful filter, and it applies beyond DeFi. You could use it to evaluate any fintech claiming to serve the underserved.
The honest answer to where DeFi is most transformative today is unglamorous. It's not replacing banks or democratizing credit. It's making the plumbing of global finance cheaper and faster. That matters enormously. $50 billion a day in USDC settlement, $12 billion a year in cheap remittances, automated insurance payouts to farmers who would otherwise wait a year. These are real improvements in real people's lives. They're just not the revolution the white papers promised.
Maybe that's the more interesting story anyway. The revolution that actually happens is usually less exciting than the one people imagined, but more durable.
The open question is whether on-chain credit scoring can achieve the scale and reliability of traditional credit bureaus. If it can, DeFi might eventually serve the unbanked, not by replacing everything that came before, but by plugging into it. If it can't, DeFi will remain what it mostly is today. Better infrastructure for people who are already inside the system.
The 1.7 billion who aren't.
They'll need something that looks more like the bundle. Credit plus insurance, plus savings, plus training, running on better rails than we have today, but still fundamentally human at the point of contact. Technology can reduce the cost of delivering that bundle. It can't replace the bundle itself.
That's a good place to land. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The dual number in Slovene, a grammatical form used when referring to exactly two of something, began declining in urban dialects in the 1950s. Around the same time that Suriname's bauxite industry was developing, new pigment extraction methods that produced a distinctive reddish-brown color used in European industrial paints. The linguistic shift and the pigment innovation are completely unrelated, but both peaked in the same decade and then faded from prominence by the 1980s.
Right. If you found this useful, rate the show and tell a friend. This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. We're back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep,
The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.